What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Alexander Sasha Pavlovsky, the first violinist of the renowned classical ensemble, the Jerusalem Quartet. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The furor in the Jewish community over the results of the recent Pew study of American Jews continues unabated this week as I struggle with a sore throat, which makes me a bass, kind of like James Earl Jonestein. Anyway, in case you missed the last week's edition of Too Jewish and my brilliant analysis of the data and our outstanding guests for the last 2 weeks, more or less on this same topic, the Pew study showed that there were actually more Jews in America than we had believed or discovered 10 years ago, but they were much less connected to Judaism as a religion and were less likely to affiliate with synagogues and other Jewish organizations. The study also found a rise in those who intermarry and are not raising their kids Jewish. If true, this is challenging stuff from the Pew study, if not to say scary, for those of us who love Judaism and work to help it thrive here in America. Well, this week, J.J. Goldberg, the former editor-in-chief of The Forward and one of the most penetrating observers of the American Jewish community, about whom he has written 3 books, by the way, J.J. Goldberg published an op-ed that basically said the Pew people made some whopping mistakes in this survey, and the American Jewish leadership is making greater ones by panicking based on an incorrect analysis of the data. First, he notes that according to any analysis, the Pew study shows that the number of Jews in America is rising, not falling, by about 18% in the past 25 years, just a little below the growth rate in the overall American population during this last quarter century. That means that we Jews are not part of a shrinking or decimated population by any means. Next, Goldberg says that Jews aren't abandoning religious practice. In fact, read carefully, we have about the same level of religious practice that we had in the 1990 survey, and the same 20% of us or so say we are not religious. Third, intermarriage rates have more or less stabilized in America, in part because the proportion of Jews who are Orthodox has risen to 10%, and Orthodox Jews don't intermarry much at all. Of greatest interest, while in 1990 only 20% of intermarried couples said they were raising their children as Jews, today that rate has zoomed up to 43%, in part because of much greater outreach to interfaith families. And, as J.J. Goldberg says, partly because in a world where half-Jews like Gwyneth Paltrow, Scarlett Johansson, James Franco, Jake Gyllenhaal, Ryan Braun, and Drake proudly identify as Jews, Jewish has become cool. And finally, while many Jewish leaders are responding in incredibly predictable ways, mostly saying, give more money to my organization so we can fix the decline of American Jewry, rates of Passover Seder attendance, fasting on Yom Kippur, Shabbat candle lighting, even Kashrut are actually rising in America. And only half of that rise is attributable to the increase in Orthodox Jewry's proportion of the population, having gone from 7% to 10%. Well, J.J. Goldberg's analysis is pretty darned accurate, in my not-so-humble opinion. I have to admit that hearing that 94% of American Jews are proud to be Jewish is reaffirming, and in stark contrast to the extreme ambivalence felt by so many American Jews at earlier periods in American history. Say, even while I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s, when it was far from cool to be Jewish in many circles. Now, prophetic predictions based on survey findings are very rarely accurate. I must note that the 1990 National Jewish Population Studies leading technical advisor wrote of American Jewry back then that it was likely the core population will decline towards 5 million, possibly even below that in the early decades of the 21st century. But now we have not 5 million Jews, but over 6.5 million Jews. I think some of this has to be credited to the great work we've been doing here at Too Jewish for the past 11 plus years. Don't you agree? To play us in on this gorgeous fall morning here in southern Arizona, where I live, here's an American Jewish singer-songwriter, Josh Nelson, singing L'Dor V'Dor, From Generation to Generation, which is really what this survey is all about.
L'Dor V'Dor, Nagid Godlecha, L'Dor V'Dor, we protect this chain. From generation to generation, L'Dor V'Dor, these lips will praise your name. Looking back on the journey we carry in our heart, from the shadow of the mountain to the waters that would part. We are blessed and we are holy. We are children of your way. And the words that bring us meaning, we will have the strength to say.
That was Josh Nelson singing L'Dor V'Dor, From Generation to Generation. He's really a fine pianist, as you could hear from that cut. From one generation to the next generation, we will praise God. Kind of what the Pew survey is trying to figure out, isn't it? On another Jewish musical front, our guest this morning plays classical music magnificently. Alexander Sasha Pavlovsky is the first violinist of one of the finest string quartets in the world, the Jerusalem Quartet from Israel, and his unique background and perspective on classical music, in Israel especially, and on representing the Jewish state all around the world is refreshing and delightful. Meet him when we return on Too Jewish. Tucson Hebrew Academy, the premier Jewish day school in southern Arizona, will celebrate its 40th anniversary in grand style. This year's Tikkun Olam celebration, gala, auction, and dinner is at the Tucson Jewish Community Center on Sunday, October 27th. The evening begins at 5:30 with a cocktail reception and silent auction. This year's special honoree is THA alumna, the late Anna Greenberg of blessed memory. Anna embodied Jewish values in action with panache and a great warm smile. She was not only a hero to the Tucson Hebrew Academy family, but to the entire community. Her courageous battle with cancer was fought with grace, a message, and a mission. It was an inspiration to us all. Renowned author and commentator Rabbi Jennifer Krauss is the evening's keynote speaker, while Neshama Karlbach, a past guest of Too Jewish, and the extraordinary Josh Nelson collaborate for an unforgettable performance of Jewish music. Jim Colby is the master of ceremonies. Contact THA at 529-3888 to reserve your seat for an inspiring evening, Sunday, October 27th at the J. That's Tucson Hebrew Academy's 40th anniversary. Call 529-3888. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. He's Alexander Sasha Pavlovsky, the first violinist of the Jerusalem Quartet, an outstanding young classical string group that's received wide international acclaim. Jerusalem Quartet is recorded for Harmonia Mundi, and their discs and, digital recordings have been awarded a number of prizes. Their recording of Haydn's string quartets won the chamber category at the 2010 BBC Music Magazine Awards. Well, a whole bunch of other awards for recording both Brahms and Mozart and other string quartet music. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Tell me, it seems to me that a string quartet is a kind of a small, intimate group. You really have to get along. Tell me about the backgrounds of yourself and the other players in the group.
Well, I totally agree with you there. A string quartet in general, it's a very sensitive, intimate family, in a way. Well, as we all understand, it contains four members. And I'm Alexander, or Sasha. I play the first violin. I was born in Kiev, in Ukraine, and moved with all my family to Israel in beginning of 90s. Our second violinist, his name is Sergei Bresler. He was also born in Ukraine, in Kharkov, and also immigrated to Israel in the same time. Our viola player, his name is Ori Kam. He plays with us. This is his fourth season. That was actually only one change in the group since 94 when we started to play together. And our cellist, his name is Kirill Zlotnikov. And he was born in Belarus, in Minsk, and also in 91 he immigrated, repatriated with the family to Israel, where we all met in Jerusalem Conservatory in very beginning of our studies in 93. You know, we were participating in the school orchestra, and soon, in a few years after, it was kind of a very natural decision that you know, all string players should try playing chamber music, and we were choosing actually to play together as a string quartet. And since then, actually, we are on, you know, on unstop travel research of music, and yes, we feel all as a big four members family.
You know, it's fascinating. Israel's always prided itself on the excellence of its classical music, even though it's obviously a very small country. The Russian influx, for want of a better term, the people moving from the former Soviet Union, have certainly transformed the music scene in Israel. You're a part of that, right?
Well, yes, of course. You know, there was a very famous joke that if you see somebody going out of the plane without violin case, he's a pianist. So, well, of course, there were a lot of musicians. Most of them are classical trained musicians who moved to Israel. But if you even take, you know, all the very famous Jewish violinists, for example, who had and lived for most of their lives in the United States, they were also, most of them, with the very strong roots from Russia, like Haifetz and Elman.
Stern, all of them.
Minsk, yes. So there are many examples. Well, you know, the tradition of Russian school of string playing is very strong. And many great musicians came out from that region, or from, you know, from the culture of this region, or from the school, violin or cello school of this region, and of course developed abroad, which was probably the most natural way, because it was very difficult to develop in Soviet Union.
In the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
We'll talk much more about that, because it's a very interesting subject, and also why so many Jews, of course, are excellent string players, when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. She's the Shlicha, the representative of Israel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here. Welcome, Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So most American Jews tend to think the idea of going home to have Shabbat with your parents is something left over from the 1950s. But in Israel, most Israelis, it seems to me, if they live anywhere near where their parents are and their parents are alive, have Shabbat dinner with their parents, even though they consider themselves completely secular. That's a very different phenomenon for us. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, and I can give you a short example from my family. Since my brother is the one that lives in Israel, lives like almost half an hour, like in Tel Aviv. So it's half an hour driving, and they will drive this half an hour drive just to attend the Shishi Shabbat dinner on Friday night, and they will get back to Tel Aviv. So this is the effort that they will made in order to have this Shabbat dinner together.
You know, it's funny. Is your brother religious in any other way?
No.
So completely secular, but mm-hmm. Shabbat is with the family.
Shabbat in Israel, it's something special. You can feel it in the air. You can some cities, like small cities, like the town that I'm coming from,
like Beit Shean, right?
It's like you have nothing to do. It's very hard not to be religious in Beit Shean. You have nothing to do, so you know, and it's very hard not to keep kosher. You will try to. You need to drive an hour and a half just to find something not kosher. So anyway, in Beit Shean or in small other lots of other small cities, it's like very no cars. People will walk to the synagogues. Very spiritual. You know.
And very peaceful.
Yeah, peaceful.
Is it boring on Shabbat?
No, it's not boring because, again, some towns that the population are, you know, more religious, so they will spend the time at the synagogues and the kids will spend the time mostly outside, you know. But for the secular, they can drive whenever they want, wherever sure. they want. So it's not boring.
You know, it's fascinating. Our perception of what's restful or relaxing in the United States is very different. The idea of actually taking a day that's different and Shabbat and, you know, not spending it watching something electronic or, you know, on your phones or basically doing work.
Or shopping,
of course. Somehow is alien, like it's against our religious convictions as Americans. It's a beautiful difference in Israel. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Jewish identity as exemplified in, or I don't know if it's exemplified or as challenged by three weddings you attended not too long ago in Europe. Jewish identity going forward seems to be an interesting mix. Is it similar in Europe to how it is in America? This Pew article came out, big study that showed that Jewish identity here is changing. It's less religious. It's sort of more cultural. It's a little lighter all across the board. It's generational. Are those kinds of changes the same in Europe from what you've seen as here?
I feel like it's different, but it's very complicated to explain the differences. First of all, some European countries require that you register as part of a given religious community, and it can be any one of dozens, but that you pay a certain percentage of your taxes to support that community.
So because the state supports religious institutions, churches, synagogues, whatever.
Somehow. So there's a system whereby you have to declare that you are a Protestant belonging to X denomination, or a Jew, or a Muslim, or whatever. And if you're completely unaffiliated, then I suppose that portion of your taxes goes to the Ministry of Education or something, because the state doesn't want to pass up an opportunity to collect taxes.
Of course.
That's some parts of Europe. Other parts, particularly parts that used to belong to the Ottoman Empire, recognized that people belong to a community without necessarily belonging to a religious institution like a church or a synagogue. So, for example, in Belgrade, Jews are affiliated with the community even if they would never set foot in a synagogue. They go to community events. They are recognized as members of the community, regardless of their level of religious practice, regardless of whether their mother was or was not Jewish, whatever. There's no minimum criterion or baseline other than knowing that some ancestor at some point was Jewish, and therefore you are part of this community. Some of that's imposed by people outside the community who regard you as Jewish rather than truly Serbian or Bosnian or Croatian or whatever else you might be in the former Yugoslavia. And some of that comes from people's own volition to assert a sense of belonging to a community which came so close to extinction. I think one major difference through much of Europe, if not all of Europe, is that so many families there were affected so directly by the Holocaust. They were deported, they were killed, they were exterminated. Vast percentages of the family were lost, so that the little bit of family that's left becomes all the more precious, and the connectedness is part of the Jewish identity. We, by and large, don't have that, especially young people in America. The Holocaust is something they may learn about in school or see about in a film, but by and large, their families were not immediately affected.
Or it may have been grandparents or something. It's just not the same connection.
Well, or now great-grandparents. And if their great-grandparents had been killed, they wouldn't be here. So it might have been the brother or the cousin of a great-grandparent, but it's a minuscule percentage of the family as opposed to 80 or 90% of the family that disappeared. I think also, and this is probably something we should talk about next week, there are far more options for how to be Jewish in the U.S. and Canada than there are in most European countries. And the plethora of options can lead both to good things and bad in terms of Jewish identity.
Absolutely. We'll talk about that next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. This one is one of my all-time favorites. A priest and a rabbi are sitting next to each other on an airplane. After a while, the priest returns to the rabbi and asks, "Is it still a requirement of your faith that you not eat pork?" The rabbi responds, "Yes, that's still one of our beliefs." The priest then asks, "Have you ever eaten pork?" The rabbi replies, "Yes, on one occasion I succumbed to temptation and tasted a ham sandwich." The priest nods in understanding and goes on reading. A little while later, the rabbi speaks up and asks the priest, "Father, is it still a requirement of your church that you remain celibate?" And the priest replies, "Yes, that's still very much a part of our faith." The rabbi asks him, "Father, have you ever fallen into the temptations of the flesh?" And the priest replies, "Yes, Rabbi, on one occasion I was weak and broke with my faith." The rabbi nods understandingly and then he says, "Beats a ham sandwich, doesn't it?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. in part because of the foibles of our national leadership, in particular the Tea Party end of the Republican Party, which closed down the federal government, negotiation gets a bad rap these days in America. Many people see the give and take necessary to reach consensus as a kind of moral compromise, a sacrifice of ideals on the false idol altar of base pragmatism. Compromise? Consensus? Agreement? Not words we have heard very much this year, and not much that has resulted out of all of the mess in Washington. But real progress in this world is usually the result of the masa'umatan, the dealing, the horse trading, the log rolling that allows society to solve problems and attain new and important accomplishments. Where difference of opinion exists, and it always does, reasonable negotiation will eventually lead us to productive resolution. The Torah teaches that lesson in several complex ways, particularly in this week's portion of Chayei Sarah. Chayei Sarah marks a transition in our Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, towards the next generation, which will feature Isaac and Rebekah. But first, we begin with an ending. At the start of the portion, we're told of the length of Sarah's life, and almost by accident, we learn of Sarah's death. The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, the Sedra begins, and the famous Midrash on it tells us that Sarah was just as beautiful at the age of 100 as she was at 20, and she was just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7. It is a fine encomium for a significant figure who now passes permanently from the scene. Chayei Sarah is also a portion filled with negotiations that will have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion someday to be known as Judaism. The first extended section is actually dedicated to arranging for Sarah's funeral, which involves Abraham purchasing the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will eventually be known as the Land of Israel. That cave becomes the burial place not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah all find their final resting place in Hebron. In Chayei Sarah, the purchase of this plot involves an elaborate bargaining session with the Hittite who owns it, and the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at a very early point in history. I once visited the Cave of Machpelah many years ago when it was safe to travel to Hebron for Jews. It's an interesting shrine, at that time filled with candles and smoke. It was even a little bit spooky. I would say that it's not worth the potential danger to life and limb implicit in a trip to Palestinian Hebron these days. After the Cave of Machpelah negotiation, the narrative in Chayei Sarah moves us forward with one last important detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham is old. He sees that his son Isaac is not married and perhaps is unlikely to do so without parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country, Sumeria, today's, Turkey, maybe Iraq, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and carry on the line of true believers in the one God. The servant goes on a great journey, all the way back from Canaan. Once there in Haran, he offers the first extended prayer passage in the Torah, asking the God of Abraham for success on this delicate mission. Immediately, Rebekah appears to draw water from the city well. The servant knows that she is the one for Isaac because she shows instinctive generosity and obvious intelligence. The servant bargains too, in this case, with Rebekah's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, they all arrange for her to become Isaac's wife, but at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebekah's family puts the question directly to her. Will you go with this man? That is, will she leave all she has known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? This final negotiation of Chayei Sarah is brief. Rebekah agrees with alacrity to go along. Yes, she will leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her. And she goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of monotheism is thus assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebekah and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, that preservation of this phenomenal history remains one of our principal goals. Often, it still requires negotiation to achieve. A secure land, Israel, our children and grandchildren's commitment to Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. But aren't these causes worth negotiating for? When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, the outstanding violinist Alexander Sasha Pavlovsky, will explain the kind of teamwork that makes the Jerusalem Quartet one of the outstanding young string quartets in the world. And we'll explore what classical music means in the nation of Israel when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The United Synagogue for Conservative Judaism held its biennial conference in Baltimore last week, attracting 1,200 people, more than double their last few biennials. By contrast, the Union for Reform Judaism conference, scheduled for San Diego in December, has already passed 5,000 registrations. Anyway, the centennial gathering of the umbrella organization of conservative temples in North America focused on the impending doom of the movement and what to do about it. The central preoccupation wasn't celebrating the past century of conservative Judaism, that milestone was hardly marked at all, but how to ensure that conservative Judaism has a future. Our house is on fire. If you don't read anything else in the Pew Report, we have maybe 10 years left, said Rabbi Eddie Feinstein of Valley Beth Shalom in Encino, California, at a session, causing a major buzz in the conference. In the next 10 years, I see the rapid collapse of synagogues and the national organization, the conservative one that supports them. If we continue what we are doing, our house will burn down. Since last week, all anyone wants to do is talk about the Pew study. I don't, said Ron Wolfson, professor of education, American Jewish University in L.A. It's time to stop talking and start doing. The conservative movement's leaders offered few specifics, sticking instead to broad outlines. Arnie Eisen, the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, proposed a threefold strategy of being as welcoming as possible, taking conservative Judaism beyond the boundaries of the synagogue, and getting members to commit more money and time to the movement. Once the largest and most influential Jewish movement in America, the conservative movement has been unable to arrest a long downward turn in synagogues affiliating with it and in membership in its synagogues. In other news, 10 longtime members of the Women of the Wall are protesting the organization's agreement to meet at Robinson's Arch if certain conditions are met. In a public statement last week, the protesting members said the Women of the Wall board betrayed the group's fundamental mission. We remain committed to the Kotel, the place sanctified by the memory, prayers, and hopes of Jews for 2,000 years, read their statement. We remain unalterably committed to the right of all Jewish women to pray together in the Ezrat Nashim, the women's section at the Western Wall, with Talit and Tefillin, reading from the Torah scroll. The board has decided by majority vote to agree in principle to pray at Robinson's Arch next to the Western Wall Plaza should the government meet several of the group's demands. Until then, the group, which meets at the beginning of each Jewish month, Rosh Chodesh, for a prayer service in the women's section of the Western Wall, will continue to pray in that women's section. Officials from Women of the Wall said the decision to conditionally embrace Robinson's arch was motivated by concern over possible legal and legislative challenges. Members of Knesset have been attempting to pass legislation restricting the group's rights. The pushback against the group's decision exposed significant divisions within Women of the Wall, between advocates of pragmatism and pure ideology, between activists in Israel and North America, and between the group's current and past leaders. 8 of the 10 signatures on the statement opposing the group's decision live in the U.S. and Canada. This is a useful way of having the group pay attention to what we're saying, said Phyllis Chesler, a founder of Women of the Wall, who lives in New York and a past guest of Too Jewish, by the way. What we're hoping for is a more transparent and democratic process that will clarify the basic vision and principles of this group. Women of the Wall's leadership, including Chairwoman Anat Hoffman, another past guest of Too Jewish, long opposed moving the group to Robinson's Arch, a solution first proposed in a Supreme Court ruling 10 years ago. Anat Hoffman has called it being in the back of the bus and insisted on the group's right to stay in the women's section, but with the government moving forward on a plan to expand and renovate Robinson's Arch for use by non-Orthodox prayer groups, the board voted 9-2 to accept the Robinson's Arch solution should it fulfill a few criteria. Among them, that the new section will be equal to the existing plaza in size, budget, and facilities, we'll see about that, and be overseen by a pluralist body of Jewish leaders. We will continue to follow this story. A tunnel uncovered last week between Gaza and an Israeli kibbutz was full of explosives and ended near a kindergarten. The 1.5-mile-long tunnel had more than one exit point in and around kibbutz Ein HaShlosha and is believed to have been constructed to kidnap civilians and soldiers or to infiltrate the community and carry out a Palestinian terror attack. The tunnel began in the Absan village located between Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip and the Gaza border fence. The tunnel was destroyed last weekend by the IDF. Israel halted the transfer of goods and construction materials to Gaza following the announcement of the discovery of that tunnel. This is the third such tunnel to be discovered in the last few months, originating from the same area. IDF officials believe that there may be many more such undiscovered tunnels. A similar tunnel was used in the 2006 kidnapping of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu commended the army for exposing the Gaza terror tunnel. He said the discovery is part of an aggressive policy against terror, despite the fact that this year has been the quietest in more than a decade. True. And lest you think that 70 years is enough time to wash away the stains of the Holocaust, there's a fascinating story from Rome this week. A weird coincidence played a part in it. On the very same week when Jews and others in Rome commemorated the 70th anniversary of the Nazi roundup of Roman Jews, protests last week forced the suspension of the funeral of Nazi war criminal Erich Priebke near Rome. Hundreds of protesters clashed with neo-Nazi sympathizers who tried to join the private ceremony organized by a fringe Catholic group, the Society of St. Pius X in the town of Albano Laziale. Priebke's body was later held in a military airport with no final decision as to where he'd be buried. Priebke's lawyer called off the ceremony because authorities did not allow people to enter who wanted to come in. Everything was ready. We were waiting for those who should have arrived to participate. Priebke died last week at the age of 100 in Rome, where he was serving a life sentence under house arrest for his involvement in the March 1944 massacre of 335 Romans, including 75 Jews. Rome city officials had barred a public funeral in Rome, and the Catholic Church leadership in Rome barred a ceremony for Priebke in any Roman Catholic church in the city. The Society of St. Pius X released a statement saying it agreed to organize a funeral for Priebke at the family's request, because no matter what the guilt or sins, every Christian has the right to celebrate Mass and a funeral. The Society, some of whose members have denied the Holocaust and made anti-Semitic statements, added, "We hereby reiterate our rejection of all forms of anti-Semitism and racial hatred." That very same week, Roman Jews marked the 70th anniversary of the roundup and deportation to Auschwitz of more than 1,000 of the city's Jews. President Giorgio Napolitano and senior Italian officials attended the ceremony last week at Rome's Great Synagogue. The president of the Rome Jewish community, Riccardo Pacifici, saying he did not want to pronounce Priebke's name in the synagogue, praised Rome's mayors, church officials, and the protesters in Albano Laziale for their stance. "We are proud to be Romans and Italians to see civil society on the front line in this battle for civilization," he said. Only 16 Jews survived the 1943 roundup in October and deportation. And that's the Too Jewish news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's Alexander Sasha Pavlovsky, the first violinist of the Jerusalem Quartet. Outstanding, qualifies as a young string group. You guys have been playing together, you said earlier, since 1994, almost three of the four of you anyway. You're now touring the world. You've been all over Europe playing a variety of programs. Tell us about how does a string quartet develop an international reputation?
Well, as I said, we started in the middle of 90s in Jerusalem, and we had a wonderful teacher who really, his name is Avi Abramovich, who gave us really kind of basis and understanding what is playing together in a chamber group, which is extremely important because I must say I'm also teaching. Of course, we go around the world and meet a lot of great musicians and soloists who has some difficulty playing chamber music because it's not only about your individual playing. Of course, it's extremely important. But this is also about listening and know to have this kind of double life of soloist, yes, and go back and let other people play or support them or play together with them or just totally disappear and to play as transparent as possible. This is, of course, the very difficult and sensitive issue of playing in a chamber group and especially in string quartet where, you know, we don't have piano, so we have only 16 strings all together, and we have always to find this balance between, you know, individual and a group. Yes. And after a few years, we got quite a lot of support because, you know, most of the chamber groups who try to play together in the school, they stop after 1 year, after half a year, because of different problems, you know, personal problems, just educational problems. People are moving from school to school. We succeeded because probably of a good friendship that we have and because of love of this music, because the repertoire of string quartet is endless and most of the greatest work were written for this ensemble. We moved on. We got, of course, supports of different organizations like Jerusalem Music Center, like American Israel Culture Foundation, who helps young musicians. And we met in Israel many, many great players, string players. Of course, Isaac Stern, who was the man behind the Music Center in Jerusalem. And we met many members of different great quartets like Guarneri, Amadeus, Emerson, also in Jerusalem, also outside. And, you know, all this gave us always push. And in 97, we just a few months before we actually went to the army to serve as distinguished musicians. In the army, we went to international competition in Austria, in Graz, named by Schubert competition and music of 20th century. And nobody expected, of course, of us this, but we won the first prize and the special prize for music of 20th century. And of course, that was probably the biggest step in a way that, you know, we understood that this is really going to be serious if we continue.
Well, once you win a gigantic prize, that's a pretty good indication you should keep playing together.
Oh, yes. Well, I cannot say that was the most important step, but somehow this international acclaim, and, you know, there were many musicians who played in the competition, and there were a fantastic jury, also members of very famous quartets from Amadeus and Melos. So, of course, that was an important sign for us that, you know, we are on the right road. And shortly after this, we had our debut in London at the Wigmore Hall. And this is one of the most important European stages for chamber music. And in that concert, you know, there were a few important agents from different companies who came to listen. And shortly after this, we already signed our first exclusive contract with a very big company, Harrison Parrott in London, who actually built our career and developed us. And of course, we develop us as well, but, you know, to have a good agent is extremely important. And we, you know, since actually 99, I think I can say that we have a really international career playing on most of the important classical stages around the world, including Europe, America, Japan, Australia. We had a lot of activities in Australia and New Zealand. we were in a residency in a fantastic organization called Musica Viva, and we had a very big, extensive tour every year. It was unfortunately finished a few years ago, but really we played maybe 50, 60 concerts in that time in Australia and New Zealand, which was extremely interesting, important, exciting. They had fantastic places. And especially since we signed with fantastic agency here in America, David Rowe Artists, our career in America growing up, it's probably also our fourth season playing so much in America. We normally have two extensive tours every season. And this is our first tour for this season.
I used to walk to my rabbinical seminary in Jerusalem, Hebrew Union College, past the Reuben Academy in Rehovia, and I would marvel at all of the young musicians and dancers going in and out. And the main campus is now at Givat Ram at Hebrew University. You attended there? You're now on the faculty there?
Yes, well, we were all studying in Rehovia, as you said, you know, right. Where you used to pass in the Jerusalem Reuben Academy. We all were studying in the Jerusalem Academy.
I might have seen you in your youth wandering in with a violin.
Maybe. Maybe it's possible. And we all, you know, completed our studies in Jerusalem Academy in Givat Ram. And yes, since probably 2007 or 8, I'm on the faculty at the Jerusalem Academy, violin faculty and chamber music. And yeah, you know, we tour quite a lot during the season. Today, I think the average of our concerts is probably around 80, 90 concerts a season, which is quite a lot.
That is a lot.
And, of course, in the time when I'm home, I'm very glad to meet my students and to listen to some ensembles. Yes, it's also exciting, and actually you learn quite a lot.
From your students.
Yes.
Mikomalam Daiskalti. I learned from all my teachers, but I learned
most
from my students.
Not only about the good mistakes, you know. It's also about something that, you know, especially very young talented musicians have sometimes magic results, and sometimes unexplainable. You not really can explain what's going on, but you think, oh, this is very touching. So you learn quite a lot about this.
You mentioned being in the army. All of you were in the IDF. It's, of course, typical of every Israeli young man and most young women. But you guys played music when you were in the army.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Yeah, well, I can only add, of course, that one of the really interesting things about our quartet, except all the traveling and things, that we actually remained in the country and we still call Israel and Jerusalem our base. For the last 4 or 5 years, our cellist, he has a family in Portugal. He lives in Lisbon, but still our base, and three of the members live in Israel. And this is also quite unusual, because most of the really famous Israeli musicians, they still decided to live abroad, because when they have more possibilities, Europe or America, and we really call our base Israel. So it was very natural for us to go to the army. I mean, of course you must, but, you know, many, many musicians left the country for studies abroad and remained there. And we also had the support from a few organizations and a few influential people who could arrange that at least we will go in the same year to the army, because we have different, little different, but differences in our age, so it was complicated. Of course, we had individually to get a status of distinguished musician, because you cannot get as a group this status, so we all had our individual exams for solo playing. We won this title, and it was really with some help arranged that we are going in the same day to the army. That was in 97, really exactly 40 days after the winning of the Schubert competition.
40 days after you won the Schubert competition.
Yes, we went to the...
You all entered the IDF, entered the
yes.
army together.
Yes, exactly, and of course after some basic training, our main job was playing concerts in the army for soldiers, for officers, and I think we succeeded to play quite a lot.
I would
maybe
not be 500 at all.
500 concerts.
500 concerts. That's hard work too.
Do you have favorite composers? You know, there is a tremendous, as you said, endless string quartet repertoire, ranging back into the earliest stages of development of string quartet music and up until today. I've seen you play a great deal of Shostakovich. Who are your favorite composers to work with?
Probably my favorite composer is the one who I'm performing on the stage.
That's a cop-out, but it's a good answer, but it's a cop-out.
Well, as a group, we from the very beginning we tried, yes, to build our repertoire very wide as possible, which means from the very early Haydn quartet. You know, we call Haydn Papa Haydn, mm-hmm, because he was the papa of string quartet.
The father of the string quartet.
Yeah, the father of string quartet. And to the very modern pieces, pieces that also written for us. Actually, yesterday in Vincent Salem, we were performing a world premiere of quartet was written by Brian Elias for us. And in Tucson, we will play two programs. And of course, from these programs, you can see that one of our favorite composers and focus today is music of Shostakovich, because we one concert dedicated totally to his music. And in the second, we also play one piece of this hymn. Well, in general, Shostakovich is close to our mind and soul, not only because three of members were born in Soviet Union.
Of course.
His cycle is definitely one of the most important quartet cycles or chamber music cycles written in the 20th century. And probably I will not make a mistake if I will call quartet number 8 is one of the most famous quartets of 20th century, quartet number 8. We perform during this season his cycle of all 15 quartets. We played it recently in New York in Alice Tully Hall. That was our really peak of the season, I think, because this is really a success. It was very successful, and you know, to get such a huge audience for such a difficult project.
I was thinking, you know, Shostakovich is legendary for the difficulty of the work. Do you enjoy the challenge?
Yeah, it's not probably the difficulty, technical difficulty of the work. It's more personal, you know, and on a personal level. It's very demanding, and it takes a lot of energy, you know.
Concentration.
Kind of inner juices, yeah. Out of audience, we would as say, well as we would out say from the musicians.
Kavana, you really have to pour everything, your soul into it.
Yeah.
Is there something uniquely Jewish about the violin?
Well, Jewish about the violin? Well, probably every mother, he always wish his son to play a violin. Well, probably it's very Jewish because Jewish...
Because Jews have adopted
Jews it. Love to sing. And probably string instruments, violin, they're more close to the human voice. That's probably the answer.
It's a beautiful answer. I want to thank Sasha Pavlovsky of the Jerusalem Quartet for a great visit. Continued success. Look forward to continuing to hear your music for many years to come.
Thank you so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and my deep voice from Baikold. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Maestro James Conlon, the 2012 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award winner, whose classical music project, Recovered Voices, has revived and performed and recorded the music of Jewish composers murdered by the Nazis. Our playout this morning comes from our guest, Sasha Pavlovsky and the Jerusalem Quartet. It's Smetana's From My Life, played magnificently by this wonderful Israeli string quartet. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Thank you.